Hello, everyone. Thank you for tuning in to the New Mainstream Podcast, where we explore the impact of multicultural consumers on marketing and media. I'm your host, Mario Carrasco, and co-founder of Think Now. Today, our guest is Natalia Infante-Kaylor, president of Infante Consulting and Research. Welcome, Natalia. How are you?
Good. Thank you. Hi, Mario. Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here. Thank you for the opportunity.
Excited to have you on. We've been talking to a lot of qualitative researchers, so really looking forward to your perspective. But before we jump in, tell us a little bit about your journey into the insight industries and how you came to be the founder of Infante Consulting and Research.
Yes, I would love to. Thank you. So my journey with insight started actually during my first year in the PhD program at Colorado State University. So that was more than 10 years ago. And during that time, I had the opportunity to work on research projects across the US and all over Colorado, where I actually live. And then as a graduate student, I worked mainly with multicultural groups, particularly Spanish-speaking participants. And then also during that time, I gained experience recruiting participants, going through the IRB process, which is the Institutional Review Board process. I helped write grants, doing lots of literature reviews, writing discussion guides, et cetera, moderating focus groups and conducting IVIs, and then also analyzing data and presenting the findings. So during that time, I also did the quantitative and qualitative part of the research. I developed DVDs in English and in Spanish to train moderators to work on some specific multi-state projects in order to ensure consistency across the board when moderating. And I also did transcriptions and translations for some projects. So I'm a native speaker of Spanish and fully bilingual, so I was able to do that part of the project also. And of all these experiences, they taught me so much, from the very basic of the research project to the more complex phases of it. And I also learned to do research following very rigorous expectations to report only the facts. So my dream when I started the PhD program was to actually get tenure and become a professor. So I did the research part of it. I taught at several universities, published in peer-reviewed journals, presented at conference so that I can get ready to become a professor once I graduated from the program.
What did you get your PhD in?
My PhD was in education and human resources with an emphasis in educational sciences. So it was mainly adult education, but then later they changed it to educational sciences.
Very cool.
Yeah. So then as I got closer to actually defending my dissertation, I discovered that I did not want to be a professor. I wanted to have a more flexible schedule, but I knew I still loved the research part of it for sure. So during my time working on my PhD program, which actually took me 9 years to finish from very beginning to very end, which is a lot. Usually the max you can do is 10 years and that's it. And I was just hitting my 10-year limit. But the main reason it took me so long was because I was also raising 4 kids as a single parent. So I needed the extra time. I needed to slow down, which was fine with me at that time. And then during that time, I also worked as the marketing director and community outreach at a financial company for a few years. So I gained experience doing that too, which was great. And then finally, in early 2018, I defended my dissertation and graduated from Colorado State University, which is known as a very high research university. So of all these opportunities, they helped me be who I am today as a professional, and I'm very grateful for that. And then several months after graduation and thinking back and forth and meeting several professionals, I decided to go solo and opened my insights business, which is Infante Consulting and Research here in Colorado, and never looked back. And then one interesting thing I would like to share with your audience is that about the name of my business is that once in a while, I get questions from non-researchers about the name of my business, which is, you know, Infante Consulting and Research. So basically think of the word infant with an E at the end. So the question I get is usually, how do you do research on infants? I'm like, what? Yes, you do research on babies? I'm like, actually, I don't. That's my family name. That's the last name, my family name from far away. So it's just funny. I think it's cute in a way. I don't know how to tell it, but it's interesting that some people think that.
Yeah, no, that's funny. So what do you specialize in? So what is Infante Consulting and Research known for?
So I do a lot of multicultural research, everything related to qualitative and some quantitative. So it's a boutique style type of research business. So I do everything from designing the discussion guide to moderating to reporting a little bit of all the multicultural part of the research.
And so, I've had some great conversations, you know, with qualitative researchers during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, the biggest change is this shift from in-person to online.
Yes.
Like for you, how was that shift? Like how much of your business was in person before the pandemic? And, you know, how was that transition for you to go online?
Before the pandemic, I will say the vast majority of my research work was face-to-face, a lot of face-to-face. And then, of course, the pandemic came and it was online. So it was a lot of quick learning and also adapting to the changes personally and professionally, and also trying to help the participants adapt to that change also, especially with the Latino population that I work the most with, was, you probably saw that before, where it's kind of challenging sometimes for them to do the research part of it, specifically, what is the word that I'm looking for? With the technology part of it. So that was that was a little bit challenging for me. That was something I needed to adapt to, and really, really fast.
Have you found, so like one thing that I thought was super interesting that I didn't really think of is that so much of the technology out there for qualitative research online is tailored for the moderator to make the moderator's life easy, right? Mm-hmm. And I feel like the technology kind of forgets about the respondent,
yes,
especially multicultural consumers, Latinos who prefer in person versus online. Like, how have you found a technology that works well with Latinos and online and qualitative, or are you using a technology that's not meant for qualitative research and you're adapting it?
I will say a little bit of both, depending on the population also. So Latinos in general, but then depends on specific population among the Latinos. So I did, and it's true, the Latino population prefers face-to-face. That's how we are wired to do like everything face-to-face. So I think it was really hard also to do research that way. But I did find two ways of doing it, and also I'm still exploring and learning as I go. To me, the important part is that it will be a tool that I can use to interview the participants, but also something where they can feel comfortable sharing their experiences, and something I will also like a tool where they could get the support that, oh, this is how we do Zoom, or this is how we do this. You know, something like that. So when I'm looking for tools, I'm always trying to make sure that they are offering that extra support also for the participants.
For sure. I mean, and so, tell us more. I mean, the obvious one of how qualitative research has changed during the pandemic is this shift from in-person to online. What are some other changes you've experienced during the pandemic about, you know, qualitative research now?
Well, there are a few. I think in a way, because the pandemic affected everybody, it's like pretty much every single person across the world. It's like we are all speaking the same language right now, in a way, meaning we were all affected in some ways or not. So I think that we changed as researchers, and we also changed as consumers or participants. And I see that across the board. It's, we have to learn to go through the challenge and learn to communicate in a much different way than before. And I think, to me, that's communication is the main thing. Of course, technology also. But in order to communicate better with other populations or with the participants, probably the same participants as always, but they change, so we need to change also. So it's like learning to see where's the gap and how I can better reach out to them.
Yeah, and I have found, I mean, and that's a positive thing, right? Like, mm-hmm. I feel like, you know, this pandemic's terrible, obviously, for many yes. reasons, but there are yes. some positive things in the research world happening, making us better listeners, adapting to technologies. Because one thing I've realized is that this has forced companies and moderators to move online. And I think one of the big barriers for reaching multicultural consumers has been time. Like, it takes a lot of time out of someone's day to drive to a focus group facility. Yes. If they have kids, to get a babysitter.
Yes.
The incentive was usually not that much. You know, the whole qualitative research ecosystem was set up with a very specific consumer in mind. Someone that works 9 to 5.
Mm-hmm.
A two-parent household, right? And multicultural consumers, many of them don't fall into the traditional job. They have two jobs. They work late hours. Maybe it's a one-person household.
Yes.
Maybe they don't have a car, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And so I have found that this pandemic and forcing qualitative research to be online has in a way made qualitative research more inclusive.
Yes, absolutely. Another thing that reminds me of is I found also specifically with multicultural populations that now that we are all at home probably and with the kids at home, they seem to have more time to share their experiences, and sometimes they are eager to share. So it's like, oh yes, please. And they love to talk and share more about it because they probably have more time to think about it. And like you said, they have the flexibility that they didn't have before. I don't have to pick up my kid from the childcare, or I don't have to take the bus, or I don't have to drive across the city to go to a focus group. Now it's like I can just sit at home while I watch my kids and you can ask me questions. So I think it made it, in a way it's good. I think it's very convenient.
And some of these changes, like I've heard from moderators, like, you know, they do miss in person mm-hmm. because I think every moderator obviously likes to interact with people. Otherwise they wouldn't, have that job. But,
sure.
But in another sense, the travel can sometimes take a toll on you. Being away from home, and now mm-hmm. moderators can do it from the comfort of their home, no travel. Like, do you think that these changes we're seeing during the pandemic are going to last beyond the pandemic? Like now that companies, moderators are used to this online qual, do you think it's here to stay, or do you think we're going to go back to in person?
I hope they are not here to stay. I would love to go back to face-to-face. I think it's not the same doing it virtually than doing it in person. I don't know.
What's missing? What do you think is missing?
It's the human contact, the eye-to-eye contact, the smile, the fact that before a focus group, we can talk to other participants. So where are you coming from? Where do you live? You know, chit-chat and get to know them a little bit better. Things like that. I don't think it's the same. The human interaction is just not there 100%. It's like, it is virtually, but it's right not the same. They're, virtually, I think they might have other distractions around them. And when we are doing face-to-face, I think we have them there and they can give it, you know, everything they have to this focus group specifically. There are changes that are going to stay probably, but I hope this is not one of them. I would really love to go face-to-face again.
What do you think are some of the changes that are going to stay?
The traveling part, probably. Some companies might realize that it's right. Well, we don't have to go somewhere else across the U.S. to do research. We can just do it virtually. Yes, probably. We can use more tools, like digital tools. That's true. There are definitely changes, the way we do conferences, probably, the way we collect information, things like that. But I don't think it's still the same as face-to-face. The human contact is not there. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I hear you. Switching a little bit, talking mm-hmm. about your focus on multicultural consumers, you know, for listeners, this is a big topic this year. I think, you know, more and more companies and brands are going to be more inclusive, including Latinos, African American, mm-hmm. Asians into their research. What are some key things that companies should think about when they're conducting qualitative research among multicultural audiences, like, or Latino audiences? Like, what are some, if you had to list 3-5 things that companies should really be aware of, what would those be?
I think there are several things, actually, that they should keep in mind. I recently read an article about a few months ago from the Pew Research Center saying that between 2010 and the year 2019, the U.S. population increased by almost 19 million. Of that 19 million, 52% of this growth came from Hispanics only, 52%. Yeah. And then 22% from Asians and 17% from Blacks. So in 2019, the Hispanic population hit a record of 60.6. So that's 60.6 million in the U.S., or 18% of the U.S. population. That is very significant, I think. So that alone, I think, can tell the researchers, the businesses, and other agencies the importance of keeping the multicultural consumers at the top of our list. So we need to learn about them, about the multicultural groups, and include them in our research studies also. I think there's a significant purchasing power among these groups and also other groups not mentioned here also. And I also think that the companies are missing out on a lot of opportunities by not conducting research among these multicultural consumers. So I think the companies should start thinking, if they haven't already, about these and look at it as a great marketing opportunity. I think it's important to know how to design or market products or services that will be more appealing to these groups specifically. Specifically, the Latino population that is growing so much. And I also think that it's important for the companies to understand them as humans and also adapt to them as consumers. So we are humans and we are consumers also. So I think the companies need to understand that so they can create more efficient marketing strategies and to try to close that gap, the communication gap of thinking that this product will be good for the entire population when in fact it will attract different populations in different ways, I think. So basically, is what works for one multicultural group might not work the same for the other. So we need to meet them where they are, the consumers.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And actually, it's a nice segue and kind of to another thing I wanted to discuss with you, like talking about identity and, you know, approaching every multicultural consumer where they're at and understanding mm-hmm. them. Like, how important is it to have a moderator that reflects the participant's identity, whether that's gender, ethnicity, ability, sexual orientation? I mean, do you think that's an important component?
Yes, absolutely. I think it's very important. I think having moderators that reflect the participant's cultural identity is very important. a moderator who shares the same, for example, in this case, the same cultural identity can ask the right questions based on the influence the culture might have on the participants. So as moderators, if we are familiar with the culture of the participants, we can probably be of better help getting the communication across. For example, one thing that comes to mind is, for example, in the US, when completing those demographic questionnaires, we are asked if we are Latinos or not. And if we say, yes, we are Latino, usually the next question is to select whether we are Native of Alaska, Native American, Hawaiian Native, etc. And many times people coming from Latin American countries are not used to those questions because we just know we are Latinos, period. So how do you explain that part to Hispanic participants that are not used to seeing something like that before? That comes to mind. And then the other part that I think is also important is when we have moderators that reflect and understand the participants' identity, the culture identity, I think we can build better trust with them, facilitating the process of sharing information from the participant to the moderator and vice versa. So it helps with the cultural integrity of the study also. Also, I think a multicultural moderator sometimes, we can anticipate the responses of the participants and can inquire better in order to hear what is representative of that specific culture. So if I, as a Latina moderator, I know that by asking a question, I kind of know the answer, but of course I can't tell them, you need to say this, but I can ask them different questions in order to get an answer that might reflect their cultural background. For example, most or some people coming from Latin American countries are known for being superstitious. I said most, not all of them. So especially our abuelitas, grandma's mom. So for example, if I'm doing a study about how to target the Latino population and better promote, let's say, life insurance, we need to understand that for most Latinos, we don't talk about death. Particularly the ones whose level of acculturation in the US is still low, they might not want to talk about life insurance. First is like, to us, life insurance in an American countries is probably something that is not very common. So they don't see it as a way of protecting their families in the future, but instead as a way of calling the death. Yes, I had a conversation with several Latino families before for a study. So the thought is, and again, this is not saying that all Latinos think the same way. It's just some or the majority. So the thought is that if I buy life insurance, for example, today, I'm going to die sooner. So understanding things like that will help us better ask questions and really get to the why. So I can go on and on. I mean, this is a topic that I'm very passionate about.
This is stuff I love, right? I mean, this is what companies need to understand.
Exactly.
Especially when we're talking about critical services like insurance, like health insurance. The way that we think about health is different. I mean, it's different. We're not, you know, so much as about preventative care, but you're right. There is, you know, there's a large percentage of Latinos that say, well, if I if I go to the doctor, I'm going to get sick. Right?
Yes. It's true. Can I offer one more example?
Yeah, please.
Thank you. I think we also need to make sure that questions are culturally appropriate and meaningful for this group specifically or for any group. So I think it helps how we carry ourselves also in front of them as participants. We're moderators, they are participants. How we communicate with them verbally or through eye contact. There are some cultures where eye contact is not very common. Others that it is important. So for example, if I'm doing a study about the effectiveness of nursing homes, for example, specifically what participants look for when selecting nursing homes for their parents, for example. So think about it. I know I can probably get great responses from people born in the US or they were born in the US several generations ago. So in the Latino culture, taking our parents to a nursing home is not very common practice at all. It's like, no way you'll do that. So our parents stay with us until the day they die. So for the most part, if there are no adult kids to take care of the older individual, I will say he or she will move with a niece or a nephew or a cousin or someone that will take care of them, but stay in the family. Here in the US, that's not so much the norm sometimes. So that's really hard. If I do, for example, a focus group with Latino participants, asking them about, something related to nursing homes.
Yeah, what? Yeah, like you're assuming something that they would never do. So, for example, you get Latinos, and you'd say to them, "Hey, what do you look for? What do you look for in a nursing home?" It's like, I wouldn't even look for a nursing home, right?
No way, never. It's like, are you crazy? Why would you do that to your parents, right? So those are just details of things that are very important, I think, when working with multicultural populations and multicultural moderators. So the other thing I will also add, based on my experience, is also speaking the same language and understanding the culture is also important, because I think that will determine the credibility of the moderator and probably the study also. So things like that, also the criteria applied to one focus group might not be applicable to another focus group because you're dealing probably with different cultures. So, you know, we need to adapt to different things depending on the culture. I mean, I told you, I can go on and on. This is, I'm very passionate about this topic. So another thing I think I will keep in mind is when reporting the findings, is also important. Having a multicultural moderator will also help capture the information in a more accurate way and portray participants' responses probably differently. Because without the appropriate cultural knowledge, we risk probably misinterpreting or misrepresenting the data that we got from the participants. And then I guess the other part where I mentioned language, I think mutual respect comes to mind. I'm not saying that if you're not a multicultural moderator, you might not show mutual respect. I am not saying that. But I think that respect in the Latino culture might be shared in different ways. So, for example, in the Spanish language, we have the formal and informal language. The tú and the usted. So in Spanish, I think, for example, when I do my focus groups or interviews, I always refer to them with a formal Spanish, unless they give me permission not to. But I always say, what do you think, Mrs. blah, 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 or Mr. blah, 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 or use the usted instead of the tú. So they feel that I am, I don't know how to say it, but I want them to feel that I am respecting and I'm honoring them as a person and their culture for this interview. Those are things that come to mind right now.
No, that's great. And thank you so much. I mean, that the best guests on the show are the ones that are passionate. So I appreciate that. And we're actually hitting up here against our time, Natalia.
This wow.
Great conversation. If people want to find you online, what's the best way to connect with you?
Thank you. LinkedIn is a really good way. So you can look for me, Natalia Infante, Kaler with a C, or look at my website information, Infante Consulting and Research. Just remember, Infante like the baby and then the E at the end. I'm very visual, so that's the way I remember things.
Yeah, but remember, it's not infant research, okay, everybody?
It's not. Very important.
Thank you so much, Natalia, and thank you, everyone, for listening.
Yes, thank you, Mario.
Thanks to everyone listening in. To get more multicultural insights, check us out at thinknow.com and follow us on social media. You can also subscribe to this podcast on your favorite platform. final thank you to our producer, Lucas Martinez, who created our intro music and makes our podcast sound great. To email him, reach out to martinez.lucas.a@gmail.com.